Hello, hello, hello. You are listening to What's on Cortina Jackson's Mind. I am so delighted that you were able to join me today. It's always such a pleasure being able to get things off of my mind. You know, when we work day to day and we go about our family business and doing different things that are important, we find ourselves overloaded with so many things that run past our minds every day, keep us clouded. It keeps us, you know, just bogged down a lot of times. And so I find myself in that state a lot of times, and finding out what's on my mind from day to day could really vary because I've got so much, you know, that I think about. I wanted to take this opportunity to talk about something that's very near and dear to my heart, and that's domestic violence. I know we hear it a lot, and the sad part about hearing it a lot is that I fear that people will become desensitized to it because it happens so often. And, you know, we don't really understand the true dynamics of it sometimes until we see it actually happen before us. We see the pictures that are oftentimes too graphic to show. And when we do see those pictures, a lot of people, they don't want to see it. They turn away. They close their eyes. They say, don't post that stuff on social media. But that's someone's reality. Someone really is having such a difficult time in their lives, and we don't understand, you know, a lot of the dynamics. I know I hear a lot of people say, why do they stay, and why don't they try to leave, and you know, these different things. You just don't understand a lot of the dynamics that go behind people staying in those type of relationships. Sometimes it's out of fear. Sometimes you cannot leave, you know, they cannot leave because there has been threats of extreme violence or death. And when a person doesn't have anywhere to go, they don't have any money, they don't have any family, they have nothing. Sometimes the only thing that they can do is stay. And think about it. In a world that's already experiencing so much themselves, do people really find themselves being helpful? There are shelters, but guess what? The shelters are full. There are organizations, but what do you do? What does a person do when they're being beaten at that moment and there's nowhere to go? Plus, that person is threatening them with violence, or I'll kill you if you leave. I'll take your children if you leave. I'll kill you and the children. You don't know. And so to be judgmental, you know, that's not what a person who's going through an abusive situation needs at that moment. Sometimes you'll never know that they're going through abuse. I'm telling you this because I speak from experience. You know, the sad part about it was I got so used to hiding the abuse that a person really would not have been able to tell that I was being abused. I kept very silent about it. I lived with a narcissist who insisted that we show this perfect life. And, you know, we had the nice two-story home, 3,500 square feet, nice cars in the driveway. I drove a Jag. He drove a Charger. We always had nice cars in and out. Every year we got something different. We took nice vacations and lots of pictures and Disneyland and these places. So you would have never known, you know, and unfortunately during those times, I thought of it as a sacrifice. I get to drive a nice car. I get to live in a nice home. We get to have great vacations. And I thought of this time as it's my dues. I'm paying dues to have a nice life. But I'm here to tell you, you know, and I'm, you know, looking back on retrospect, you never have to pay dues for a good life. It is yours for the taking. The wonderful thing about the universe is it's big enough for all of us and all of us to experience joy. And when you are not living at your full potential, when you're not walking in your purpose, when you're being hurt and each day is going by, you're not living up to what was promised us. If you're a believer like I am, I believe in God, and God has promised these things to us. And I was not walking in my purpose. Each day I walked on eggshells instead. I was fearful, you know, that I didn't want to rock the boat. I didn't want to have the wrong conversation. I didn't want to accuse him of anything because it would cause an argument that would always end in a fight, which would always end in bruises or scratches or cuts or something that would happen, you know, in my life. And I didn't deserve that. But at the time, I couldn't see it. Something else, another reason people stay is the extreme manipulation and mind control. Mind control is very real, folks. It really is. A person can go through such extreme circumstances that sometimes they crack. I know they came up with this movie called Split not long ago. This person had multiple personalities and alters and these different things going on. It's a very real thing, mind control, manipulation. When you're with an abuser and you've gone through such extreme things, oftentimes you become, and in my state, almost like a robot. Almost, you know, for me, my cues or my clues were a look. If he gave me a certain look, I knew it wasn't going to go well. And so I kept things lighthearted. When we would get into it and I knew the abuse was coming, I just almost buckled up and went for the ride because it was going to happen. I wasn't the type of person that just, at first I was the type of person that just took it. I took the abuse. But after a while, I thought to myself, if I am going to be abused, I might as well fight with all my might. And I'm going to lose the fight. I already knew I would lose. But just fight back with all of my might. Did I fear that it would be a worse abuse? I don't know. Did I have anything to lose at that point? I didn't. And so it did make things a little bit worse. But, you know, I was fortunate in that he ended up getting a job away from me. And he would only come back to town on the weekends, which made things during that period very nice. Because when he came in happy for the most part. And that's when we went to the movies and got to enjoy things. And so I found this to be one of the better times, one of the better years or year of my relationship, my marriage. Stay tuned with me. I'm going to come back this next half and talk about the abuse from beginning to the very end when I was almost killed by my abuser. And I'm so happy to have this platform because I'm really hoping to talk to more people who have been through domestic violence. Don't take it. You know, that's easy to say. That's easy to say. I'm out of it now. But, you know, it's easy for people to say, get out, get out. But we're going to talk about some of the dynamics that made me stay. And I hope to talk to other survivors, other people being abused. So you can kind of get an overall picture of this important topic because it's very sad and it's going on. People are losing their lives. I would like to give this shout out at this time to Don Estes. Don lost his niece, I believe, last Thanksgiving to domestic violence. She was killed violently. Her name was Tina. And he heads up, it's what he calls Team Tina Break the Silence. Don has spoken to legislators, to every, he screamed it out on news outlets, any person he can in every state trying to pass Tina's law, where abusers, domestic violence abusers, have to register, just like sex offenders and, you know, these different registries. He is fighting for, he's fighting for us. He's an advocate. He's standing for us. And I thank him so much. Like I said, Tina was killed last Thanksgiving. And what happened with that was that she had a boyfriend and they had already broken up. They, you know, he was abusive during the relationship. But what happened was while they were broken up, I believe his parents encouraged them to come together and talk one last time, you know, just talk things out. And that was on Thanksgiving Day, that morning or that night before. And reluctantly, she went and met with him. And when she did, they got into an argument, something ensued, and he ended up beating her with his fist. He started punching her over and over, so violently, so vicious. He beat her so hard and so long and so violently that he broke both of his hands until the bones protruded out of his hands. He punched her that much, got on top of her and punched her until the bones came out of the skin and were sticking out. He wasn't finished. When he could no longer use his hands to punch her, he began stomping her body. This poor lady was only 100 pounds or so. I don't know. Just a small frame woman. He began stomping her with his boot, stomping her body, stomping her chest, stomping her head until she was not even recognizable. She didn't deserve this. She was a wonderful soul. From what Don described, she's the kind of person that would make peanut butter sandwiches and go down under the bridge and feed the homeless. She always wanted to make people laugh and make people happy. She was an absolute beauty. She looked like Sandra Bullock. Just a gorgeous woman. To me, a lot more gorgeous. And he did this to her to where you couldn't even tell what she was. That's what domestic violence looks like. Yeah, it's graphic. But yes, it's important because we don't want anyone else to experience that. It's very sad that, you know, I met Don under those circumstances and we lost Tina. But I stand as an advocate. Team Tina, break the silence. If you have social media, if you want to contact, contact the lawmakers, and please do, to pass Tina's law. Stay with me as I get ready to tell you about my own story. And thank you so much for joining these. I will be getting back with the stories in my book, but I wanted to stop here in the middle of all of everything going on to remind people to get involved. If you see something, say something. You may not want to jump in the middle of something. It is dangerous, but call the police. Don't ignore screams for help. Don't ignore your neighbor when they're constantly getting beat on. Don't just say to yourself, well, that person's still there. They must love it because they're still in there. Get involved. It's the only way we're going to make this stop, you guys. Thank you so much. Make sure you go to my website at www.cortinajackson.com. Hang tight as we come back with the story of living with a narcissistic, physically and emotionally abusive police officer. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about my domestic violence situation. To start things off, I wanted to give a little bit of background, you know, about myself and what started it all. I actually grew up in a Christian upbringing, a very God-fearing family. My uncles are pastors, my dad, my mom is a district missionary for the Church of God in Christ. We come from a Pentecostal background. A lot of people know the Pentecostal faith as Holy Rollers, or, you know, the religion that speaks in tongues, or if you know anything about the Church of God in Christ, it's a very, at the time, it was a very strict upbringing. We went to church all the time. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday evening. We stayed in church quite a bit. So we were a God-fearing family. This is noteworthy because sometimes when you're in a narcissistic relationship, the narcissist will find out your strengths, your weaknesses, your likes, your dislikes, things that are important to you. And sometimes they'll use those things for their manipulation tactics later. So being close to God was very important to me. It's been important throughout my entire life. And, you know, this was the case for me being married to a narcissistic person. It doesn't matter where you go or who you meet or what type of person you are. You will encounter wicked people. So being a Christian didn't shield me from meeting evil people or an evil person. It was only a tool that could be used to turn my belief upside down and cause me to distrust God. And I believe in my case, this is precisely where Satan wanted me to be. What a narcissistic move, you know, on his part, because the goal was to make me lose my sense of identity, my hope, and my self-esteem. When I met my now ex-husband, he wasn't evil that I knew of. As a matter of fact, he was everything I was looking for. I met him online, and there was the problem for me. I lived in a small town, and I worked all the time, so I found it very hard to meet men. I'd just come out of a divorce. Oh, a few years, you know, I'd been divorced from my first husband, and just always working. I went to school full time, couldn't meet people. So I went to a dating site and met this man, and I read his profile. He had a cute baby on his knee, cute baby boy. And, you know, he said he was a godly man. And I was impressed the more that I learned of him. I thought, wow, he's exactly what I'm looking for. And so this is how I met him. On my profile, I was very adamant about being a Christian. And I told him, you know, I'm Church of God in Christ. And I was very transparent of who I was. And you know, like I said, he was the man that I was looking for to the T. When I got together and met him, he still seemed like a great guy. But I began to notice some things even before the marriage. Even while we were dating, he would call me all the time. He would call me throughout the day and just to see how I was doing, just checking on me. And I thought that was sweet at first. I thought, wow, he's always checking on me. He seems to really care about me. And I was very impressed with this. You know, I'm thinking this, you know, this guy's pretty nice. But it was persistent. And I thought, you know, you don't get rid of a person because they have, you know, because he loves me too much. Wow, you know. We ended up getting married. And the things that I thought were cute before, now they weren't so cute anymore. Now he was checking up on me all the time. He was checking on my bank account. We had a joint account. So any money I spent, he was right there to check the account and always asking me about my spending. If it was buying a hamburger, whatever it was, he was right there on it. And the first time he ever hit me was only a month into the relationship. It was supposedly a misunderstanding. He thought that I talked about his sister. I did not. I think we were talking about paper plates and, you know, something about, well, I use paper plates in my family. You know, your sister likes that fine china, but I can't afford, you know, we did just as good without it. And when I said that, he went into a rage. Like, it was instant. We went from just talking and I thought joking around to a person I had never seen before in our short time, you know, only a month. But it was so odd that he would change so quickly over a misunderstanding. I never said anything, you know, out of line, out of place. He grabbed me and he kind of pushed me. We had stairs in the apartment. So he pushed me, grabbed me and threw me against the wall. He had placed bruises on my arms and my back. And I was so distraught that I immediately grabbed my phone and I told him, I'm calling the police. I'm out of here. The thing I didn't say was that he at the time was a police officer. And I guess he didn't want to be in trouble because he instantly apologized. I'm sorry. I can't believe that happened. I'm sorry. I thought you said something else. And then he began to make excuses. I'm stressed out. You know, we just got married. And then I'm a police officer and I got a lot of things on my mind. Things at work have been stressful and I snapped and I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I can't believe that happened. I've never hit a woman before. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, he was just so apologetic. So I hung up the phone and I was like, I'd never been treated that way. To tell you the truth, I was raised in a family. I didn't even hear cursing a lot. My family didn't curse. I never heard language like that. It may sound like I lived under a rock and maybe we did, but I liked my lifestyle because it was very sterile. But I forgave him. I was brand new to the marriage, you know, and thinking, okay, you know what? I forgive you. But it didn't even take long before it happened again, maybe about a month later. My kids at the time still lived in with my mom so that we could build a home. The goal was to build this home and then my sons were going to come because we didn't want to split up their school year. But when the boys came, things got so much worse for me. I'm super close with my sons. Oh, I love those fellas so much. And we were very close, very playful. Very silly together. My oldest son always loved to hug and kiss on me. We're just crazy like that. And my ex-husband didn't like that. And I would catch him looking at my sons, you know, almost with a jealousy in his eyes. He didn't want them playing with me. So when my son would kiss me, he would, you know, get off of her. Quit being a baby. Stop kissing on your mom so much. You're a man. And I would tell him, no, it's okay. It's okay. I like when they kiss me. I love my sons. But he did not like that. And he voiced that many times to where the boys didn't feel comfortable with even hugging me anymore and kissing me. He was always on them about that. He was, the abuse got worse because he began, the first time he tried to discipline my boys. Now, keep in mind, he had already abused me many times before they even arrived. And I stayed. Here's that thing again. By then, I thought, we're in the middle of building this home. My sons are eager to come. Perhaps when they come, things will be better, and this is a better life for them. We're staying in a nice, affluent neighborhood. They're going to go to nice schools. You know, maybe things will be better. When he disciplined my sons, I think they got bad grades in school, and he came home and he said, the boys are getting a whooping. They're getting a whooping. And so I remember him pulling off this big leather belt and marching upstairs, and he made the boys undress, stark naked, nothing. They were to have nothing on. And I remember I was downstairs, and I heard him beat them and beat them and beat them so long. They were screaming and they were crying, and the belt, I could hear the licks. They were harder and harder. He was beating them. I finally screamed upstairs and said, that's enough. That's enough. And he came downstairs, and I was so tearful. I felt so helpless. I didn't want to step over my bounds as being, the mother against the father. You know, I didn't want to show division, but that was extreme. It happened one more time like that. And I didn't protect myself during these times, but I was adamant. You will never touch my children again. You are not to handle the discipline for them. And so he began to turn his abuse on me, and I took it. I took it at the time because I believed still my boys were getting a good life. And when I was not being beat up, things were okay. As long as I did not make him mad, things were okay. We would, like I said, go to the movies. We go out to eat to fancy restaurants. A narcissist wants to put on that they're more than they are. And in this case, like I said, we had the big home and the nice cars, and he wanted this portrayal that we're this happy family. My sons were good in football. They were going into high school. And they were good in track. They were good. So he had this lifestyle that he was portraying, but he was just an evil, evil person. And so to wrap things up, I later wanted to become a police officer. It was something I always wanted to do. And so when I voiced that I wanted to become a police officer, I was met with so much opposition, so much. He began to abuse me more. I was trying to study for my police exams and tests, and he would always come up with an argument while I was trying to study with, little cue cards and little index cards I made to brush up on the law and different things. He would always, when I would come home, always go into a fit of rage where I couldn't even study. So I would have to study on the road and while I'm driving, during this time, one night he hid my workout clothes. If we ever came to class unprepared, it was a demerit. If we got too many demerits, we were actually kicked out of the police academy. So he hid my clothes one night. And early, early that morning, I got up and I couldn't find my clothes. And I found them. He hid them in the trunk of his car. I don't even know what made me go to the trunk of the car, but there they were. And when I found them, I took them to the bedroom, and I kind of hid them under me. And he woke up a little bit after me, and he noticed that I'd found the clothes. And he began to yell at me, and I knew what was coming next. And I remember running out of the door. And when I did, he chased me and knocked me onto the ground, and he began to rip my neck open with his fingernails. So I had these deep lacerations across my neck where the skin was hanging and I was bleeding. But it was time for me. By then, the sun came up. It was time for me to get to the police academy, and I went. I remember I had these open cuts deep in my throat. And that day we were being sprayed with chemical agents. And that's the first time it was ever discovered that I had been abused, because I went to my trainer and I showed them the cuts, and I was worried about the spray getting into those cuts. And when they asked me, because I'm telling you, it looked like Wolverine had went across my throat. And they asked me, how did you get that? I told them it was my husband. To make a long story short, big investigation happened. What's so sad about it is I was so mind controlled by that time that I defended him. Oh, I went to bat for him. Please don't fire him. Please don't fire him. It was my fault. We got into it and he didn't. And I tried hard to defend this person. And ultimately, they fired him anyway. They ended up firing him from his department. And I graduated the academy and started working as a police officer. And he started harassing me on my job, because now he had no job, but we had to pay the bills. So though I was working, he was calling my department and threatening to come up there if any man ever talked to me. And he was calling my superiors, telling them, you know, he was coming up there. So my department was involved, and it just, you know, it was just a terrible, terrible thing. He ended up convincing me to quit the department. He came with an apology, like he always did. It was always an apology and a gift. Every time an abusive thing happened that was so horrible, it was always followed up by a great gift, a brand new car. We're going on vacation. I bought you a bed, this big post bed that I always wanted. It was always followed up by a great gift. So he apologized. And you know what he used to get me back? God. The very thing that he knew was important to me. Oh, he quoted scripture. God says, you know, a man and a woman are joined together. Let no man put asunder. You know, a man leaves his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one. He quoted all kind of scripture and asked for my forgiveness and said he wanted to be the husband that he was meant to be. And I should just quit the department and let's move to Houston. By then, the boys were graduating high school and we were about to go off to college. And he convinced me, let's make a new start. That's all we needed. You know, the boys, they, you know, I felt a little jealousy with the boys, but now they're going away. And I think we're going to do good if we move to Houston. And I quit. I quit the department. This moved me further away from my family. I didn't know anyone. I had no friends in Houston. And my sons were off to college. They were in Wisconsin. And so it was just me and him. And I thought it was going to be a great new start. And I was terribly wrong. So when we moved to Houston, things were okay for a little while. But then I made a discovery. I discovered he had been cheating. I found some things that he had put ads out on Craigslist for sex from other women, and just all kind of things that had happened since the beginning of our marriage. It had been going on for years. By then, we were about 9-10 years into our marriage, and this had been going on ever since. He faulted me for finding out stuff on him, for digging in his business, and the abuse got worse. The bruises, the cuts. Now, because he was a police officer, it was important that he didn't show anything visible to my face. So he would never hit me in the face, but anything that could be covered with clothing, that's where the bruises were. It was important that he didn't show that to anyone. And I covered it up as well. I went along with it. I didn't want anyone to see. I didn't want anyone to know. And so you wouldn't have known if I didn't show you. I also hid the pain and the bruises with a beautiful smile. I'm always smiling. I do it now. I'm very funny and charismatic. And I got good at being a clown. I call it now being the clown, because it was like I was wearing a clown mask. When you, on the outside, you see this clown with this happy face, but you have no idea what the person looks like underneath the mask. Underneath my mask was pain. Oh, just the most extreme pain and sadness you could ever imagine. So I was the clown. You know, by the way, I'm so happy that I don't have to be the clown anymore. But at the time, I was. And so one day, and this, you know, I'm trying to go ahead and sum of it, everything up. I began to write a book. I didn't have anything. I was starting over at a new job, and I began to write this book. And I was on it all the time. At the same time I'm writing this book, I'm getting a degree. I'm getting a master's degree. Every time I tried to progress in life, I was always met with opposition. He always went against it. He always, you know, he didn't support me. And that's because a narcissist is only concerned with supporting themselves and uplifting themselves. They're not interested in uplifting, you know, you. And so you find that you will support their dreams and goals, but rarely will you get them to support yours. I was writing this book diligently. And I was at the point where I wanted to make some cards to start, you know, advertising this book and start getting things going. And I remember one day I asked him for some help. It was 2 days before my birthday, so he was on the couch watching TV, and I was working on my book stuff, and we were going to go out and eat afterward to celebrate my birthday early. When I asked him for help, he went into another one of those rages that I was talking about. I know you've heard some people describe that a person will have a different look in their eye, almost like their eyes go black, almost like they're not human. He got so angry at me asking him for help that he walked over to me and threw all of my papers, everything went flying. Everything went flying in the air. All of my papers, my book. I'd been working on this. I'm old fashioned, so I wrote it by hand. And all I could think of was, oh my God, my book. To keep him from thinking that the book was so important, I acted like the pain of him hitting me was more important than the book, because I knew whatever he thought was important to me, that's what he was going to torment me with. So the pages were all over the floor by then. And I remember I kind of laid over them and kind of began scooping them up, gathering them up. And he was yelling at me, "You're so stupid. You're so dumb. You can't do anything right. I always got to help you. You can't do," you know, he was just going into this rage. Well, I'm just, you know, shaking my head yes and gathering up these pages. And so what I did is I went to the closet and I began to put those pages in a book bag, and I threw them, the book bag, in deep into the closet. And then I came out of there kind of holding my head, kind of holding myself like I was hurt, so that he wouldn't concentrate on those pages anymore. And when I went to walk past him into the living room, he attacked me. He jumped on me and he began to beat me really relentlessly. And I remember he body slammed me. I remember this because I was on the floor blinking and looking up at the ceiling, trying to gather my bearings and think, what happened? What's going on? All I could think was to start kicking. So I remember kicking, trying to kick him away and moving my body in circles, kicking to keep him away. Well, he's a big guy. He got past that and he grabbed me around my throat and he began to take his hands. And before he did that, I remember him grabbing handfuls of my hair and he pulled my hair so tight that my eyes were, I could feel my eyes going back to my ears. Everything on my scalp, it felt like I was being scalped. But apparently that didn't do it for him. You know, he didn't feel like he was pulling out any hair, or he didn't feel like that was doing anything to me. Though I was kind of yelling as he's pulling. And that's when he grabbed me around my head and my throat. And he began twisting and twisting my head and twisting. And I remember hearing the bones in my neck crack and pop. And at that moment, I got such a sense of sadness. A sadness began to come over me. And I just began to think, this is how I'm going to die. I'm about to die. And my kids aren't here. And my family's away. And no one's going to know that I'm dead. No one's going to know, you know, unless he tells them. And this is how they're going to find me. And though he was cracking and cracking, I guess I didn't die right away. So he put me in a chokehold and he began to twist with all his might. And it felt like my head was going to be ripped off. Something told me to get into the fetal position. And I remember getting down and crouching down and tucking my chin into my chest. And he could no longer twist like he wanted to. And I remember he jumped up and ran into a back room. And when he did, I got up off the floor and I ran over to my purse and my keys that I kept hidden, because I was in the practice of hiding my keys and my purse, because he would take those things so that I couldn't leave. He would shut the money off at the bank so I couldn't get any money. I already knew his practices. So I would hide my purse and my keys. I always kept a little money, and I always kept phone numbers written down on paper in case he ever took my phone. And I ran out of that apartment, and I ended up staying away from the house. I remember crying. I was just devastated. I was thinking, why would he do that? I don't understand. Why would he do that? This was supposed to be a happy time. It was my birthday. I didn't understand. I really didn't understand why. The next morning I went to work. And when I got to work, I collapsed and I began to just wail. I wailed with so much sadness. My supervisor called the police. And that was the day that my abuse ended. The police did arrest him and he went to jail. And I had one day to get as much stuff as I could and put it in my car and leave. All this time, I wouldn't leave because I needed the money. I didn't have enough money to make it on my own. But now I'm forced to leave quickly with nothing. Nowhere to go, nowhere to turn. I put clothes, I put my important documents, and I went and got that book bag with my book in it and stuffed it into the car, and I fled. I went to Dallas. I moved back from Houston to Dallas. I had all my things in the car. You couldn't even see in my car for the clothing and different things in there that was stacked up. And I went to an apartment, first one. And the lady showed me the apartment. I didn't have any money. I really didn't. And what struck me was that this apartment had a security system. And it was nice. It was one bedroom. And I was just like, she was showing me and she was telling me how much it was going to cost. And I didn't have the money. And I said, ma'am, thank you for showing me this apartment. I love it. It's perfect. I said, I'm literally coming off the road. I've been in some abuse and I'm just looking for a place to stay. And thank you. I really can't afford it right now, but I thank you. And that lady went to her apartment manager. I don't know. By the time we got back to the office, she said, you're never going to believe this. We have a look and lease special. You can move into that apartment with nothing down, and we're going to waive your first month's rent. And I was still thinking, wow, but I don't have any money. I still don't. She said, as a matter of fact, you don't have to pay for 2 months. You don't owe anything, nothing down. And she handed me the keys. And on top of that, that supervisor who called the police made some phone calls and got me a job, got me a transfer to another office in the Dallas area. And my life has not changed. In my life, I got a new start, you guys. I got a new start in life. Was it easy after that? Oh, heck no. There was a time and period of depression. There was suicidal thoughts. A lot went into that. It took, you know, a couple of years of adjustment, trying to get back on my feet. Taxes came up, like different things I hadn't even thought of came up, and it just tore me apart. But I'm here to tell you, there is a happy ending. One day, I was so depressed. I had my highs and lows, and I said, God, if you don't help me, I'm going to die. And I know that meant I was going to die of a broken heart, and I was going to die bitter and broken. And a friend, an author friend, her name is Christy Stratos, shared the secret with me. I had heard of the secret before. Ask, receive, believe, law of attraction. Sure, I've heard it. I tried doing it. But this time I listened. A woman prayed for me. I watched the video with Oprah and The Secret. And I began to say, thank you. That day, and here we are, you know, fast forward, this was 190. Now I'm at 196 days. 196 days ago, I started a gratefulness journal, a thankfulness. I decided each day I would write something that I'm thankful for, no matter what was going on in my life. Even though things were bad, even though I was depressed, I would just say thank you. Thank you for waking me up this morning. Thank you, I have a job to go to. I may not like it, but thank you. And I would say nothing negative, nothing at all. You guys. It is day 196. Do you know everything I started writing, not only was I thankful for, but things I wanted to happen in my life? I've always wanted to act. I am proud to say I am now an actress. My first role was in a movie called Beneath the Scar. And as a matter of fact, we're having a red carpet premiere March the 3rd in Irving, Texas. I play the part of Mrs. Gray. And get this, here's the irony. I play the part of a woman being abused by her abusive police officer husband. You guys, the director didn't know that I had been through this, and I didn't know that this was the role. I actually auditioned for another role and got this one. Without even really knowing what the story was about, I got this role. And from then, I have just recently got a new role in a movie, or it's going to be a series called The Family. I get to act in a series. I was an extra in a movie called Firebones that's coming out. I'm going to be doing a stage play. I've done 2 voiceover projects. You guys, I have had multiple radio show opportunities. And now I am the co-host of a Sirius XM radio show called Live Your Best Life. You guys, I am living my best life. I'm living my best life. I don't even recognize the Tina from back then who didn't have a voice, who had the clown mask on, who cried all the time. Now my smile is so real. I'm so happy. I'm so excited. I'm so excited, you guys. I am truly living my best life, and it's only getting better. Things are better. I'm still doing my thankfulness and gratefulness journal. I'm still realizing that this big world, this big universe, this big God that I serve, wanted this for me, but I couldn't have it as long as I was negative, as long as I still harbored hate and unforgiveness and distrust. But the minute I said yes, the minute that I said I believe, the minute I said thank you, my entire life changed. I urge you, if you are going through domestic violence, though it may be extreme, whatever you're going through, the one thing they can't take from you is your belief. If you don't believe in God or if there's not a higher power, believe in the power of the universe to give you exactly what you want because you deserve it and it is rightfully yours and you shall have it. You begin to tell yourself, I am free. I am happy. Even if you're going through it at the time. Because see, I was doing this even though I was depressed severely. I was still saying, thank you. I will be better in life. I will do good things in life. I'm going to do a radio show. I'm going to have the everything I wrote in that journal, you guys. And I'm just kind of trying to speed this along. Everything I asked for, and I'm not exaggerating, I received. I'm so thankful. And that is my story. And I'm so glad that you joined me in this journey. So when you see me and I'm doing great things in life, know that I come from humble beginnings. Know that I come from a very real place. And know that my feet will always be on the ground. I will always be humble. God help me. I will always be humble and remember where I've come from. And I'll definitely remember where I'm going. I have gone from walking on eggshells to walking the red carpet. I'm so proud. Thank you for listening. And I hope that you'll stay with me. That book that I've told you about, I finished that book. That book that he tried to destroy is called On Earth as It Is in Hell. And then I wrote a second book called The Sounds of Silence Are the Loudest. I would be honored if you would read those. I worked so hard. There's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, literal tears on each of those pages. You can find those at www.cortinajackson.com. Please let me know that you've heard this. Join me on social media. Let me know where you've heard this. I'm on Facebook at Cortina Jackson. I'm on Instagram at Miss, M-I-S-S, Miss Tina _ the writer. I'm on Twitter at Tina the writer. I'm on LinkedIn, Cortina Jackson. I'm everywhere, you guys. I'm everywhere. I'm even on YouTube. I have a YouTube channel. Find me. Connect with me. Let me know how you heard me. And join me in this journey and, you know, in this progression in life. I'm so thankful. I'm so thankful for you. I pray that all is well in your lives as well and that you find the abundance and joy that you so deserve. Thank you. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.